Proudly presented by the U.S. Army, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation with 101-year-old Jack Wolf. Originally from Arizona, he has long made his home in California's San Joaquin Valley, where his efforts in the areas of agriculture, water issues, and philanthropy were recognized with an honorary doctorate from Fresno State. But that never would have happened. His businesses never would have been founded. He never would have met his wife of nearly 70 years, Bernice. And dozens of descendants never would have been born if he didn't make it through some of World War II's most ferocious battles. We'll hear about the Normandy invasion and the Battle of the Bulge and how Jack experienced those as the commander of Battery A in the 204th Anti-Aircraft Artillery Battalion.
We had a supply sergeant that I don't know whatever happened to him. I wouldn't be a bit surprised he got put in jail if he carried out what he was doing for us. Our unit had no tents. We lamented that we had lived long enough in pup tents. He came to me and said if he could use the trucks for a few hours, he thought maybe he could find some tents. And a forward airfield, and the pilots all had tents lined up, and he went through and struck the tents, threw them on the truck, and hauled them away and left the cots, the pilots' cots out in the open. He was that sort of a guy. He could find stuff. He found 4 truckloads of dynamite one time, and that sounds crazy for anti-aircraft. But if you're digging holes or a base to get into for your gun, it sure helps to blast it with some dynamite.
Well, and when you told that story of him pulling the switcheroo with the pilot's tents from the airfield, I'm just wondering, you know, if they figured out who did it and came and buzzed your position.
No, they didn't. At least they didn't come, as far as I know.
Well, you said you headed overseas in January of 1944. Had you ever in your life been on a ship before?
My first time, but there were 18,000 on that ship. We were in a convoy, of course. It took about 10 days to get to Liverpool. That's where we disembarked and stayed at a small community out of Liverpool called Leeds. And we stayed at Leeds until our guns and so forth all came. Then went to Weymouth on the southern part of England and set up, and we were disappointed that a battery was about 3 miles inland from the port and the others, but that was part of their game plan. We were the first to move overseas of our battalion, and the others followed. We stayed there, well, from about 1st of February till invasion date.
Well, I want to hear what you were doing in that time period, but I wonder, too, because I'm trying to put myself in your shoes, and I didn't live through this. I may be completely off, but I'm guessing that if you're on this ship going across the Atlantic, and you can't get off the ship, you can't go anywhere, you probably have a lot of time to think. Did you think that you were ever going to come back to America? Did you have that concern that you may lose your life over there?
Well, frankly, I did not. I guess some may dwell on that, but I think the average GI thought that he was invincible. I don't know about an infantry guy, the first ones out, but in my case, I never thought that I wouldn't make it.
And so from February till June, you're in England. You continuing to train? Are you seeing examples of what war is like right there in England?
Well, we were in place, and we fired at German planes a time or two. At that period of time, there were more German planes than later. Once in a while, we'd hit a plane, and that day, by the standards of today, the plane had to almost search out our fire and fly into it to get knocked down. But we had that, and if one plane went down, everyone claimed credit. So about 20 different batteries would claim credit.
Well, and one of the things that was happening at that point, you talk about German planes, they had a lot of German fighters that would fly at night and try to shoot down American planes coming back from their bombing missions. Is that who you were firing at, those invaders?
Well, some of it was at night, some of it was during the day. I don't want to overemphasize that. We probably had a dozen times over the 3 months we were there.
Well, and this may seem like a basic, obvious question. I know you're going to be experiencing this a lot more once you went across the channel. But as far as how those gun crews operate, how many people does it take to run one of those emplacements? And what was your specific role in how that battery operated?
My specific role was to find there were eight cannons in a battery, and each gun section had two turret 50 caliber. And so you had the three units times eight. Battery commander had to locate those. And if there was something to be, as they said, protected, then you were supposed to locate them so it would be kind of, well, protect the site. But you didn't want to fire on your own people. So as a battery commander, you had to find the location. When you moved to a new site, you took with you your first sergeant and your communications sergeant. And we'd move into an area. I would pick the sites, and then my first lieutenant, executive officer, would bring up the guns, and the first sergeant would kind of know which direction to point them. Our communication guy would be laying the telephone wires to our battery office.
As the commander of your battery, are you the one that has to give an order to fire?
No. If they saw an airplane, you just fired. Now, let's jump forward. Okay. Now we're out. We're on Normandy. We've just gotten there, and that was under our tight control. You'd either have a period where you were supposed to not fire at anything because we had so many aircraft, or U.S. or Allied aircraft coming from England. There were just dozens of them. And then there would be a period when they'd all go back to refuel, and anything in the air, you were told to fire on it. And so we had that back and forth.
And, you know, so much has been said about D-Day and the whole Normandy invasion, and people know about the loss of life. They know how important that day, the longest day, was to that whole operation. But what about the lead up to that? How far in advance did you know that you guys would be crossing the channel?
Well, whatever date here.
You have your orders. They say top secret headquarters, southern base section. And it's got your outfit on it, Battery A, 204th AAA. It says the priority list and the embarco plan indicates that your unit is now in its concentration camp, Weymouth, after complying with POM SSV, vehicle waterproofing, acquisition of required equipment and supplies, and other preparatory functions. You will be prepared to move on or after 2 June 1944 on 6 hours' notice. You'll receive further instructions on exercise hornpipe through command channels. And again, it's noted top secret. So when you see these orders, what goes through your mind?
Well, we have been training to do just that, and the time had come. It's been a long time ago. You asked, what did I think that day? I don't really recall what I thought that day, except we knew that we would be going over the channel. On the day after we got that, we got the six-hour notice, and we moved then to Southampton and boarded the LST.
And how many men in your battery?
165 men. Myself as battery commander, had an exec officer, and then had two platoons. And each platoon had a first lieutenant and a second lieutenant.
So here, I mean, this is more than 3 years after you entered the Army. You've had all this training. You've had exercises in the States and there in England. You know what you're supposed to do, what you're going to be doing. You've already been firing on German planes there in England. But did any of that prepare you for what you saw when you got to Omaha Beach?
Well, I don't think so. It was amazing, Omaha Beach. The magnitude and all the action that was taking place and the ships. And as we came in, we were supposed to, once we got loaded on the LST, our LST moved, anchored near the Isle of Wight. We didn't see anything until a couple of days later. We all of a sudden became aware that there were just planes everywhere circling in the air and pulling gliders and off to the sea. There were just hundreds and hundreds of landing craft moving, had destroyers around, but they were moving, and you knew then the day had come, and it was just a matter of time. We moved out of the Anchorage, and that's when we received a packet of orders, and it mostly was maps of where we were supposed to go, maps that maybe were about 4 by 4 feet, and some of them had such detail that you could tell exactly where you were supposed to end up and put a gun. Our order said that 8 hours after the first landing, we were supposed to land on D-Day. It turned out that they had problems, as we all know, at Omaha Beach, and they pulled our unit off to the side behind some battleships, and we stayed there exactly 24 hours. It was a long 24-hour, because we were at the point where swells kept that boat moving all the time, and the battleships were firing. So anyway, there was a lot going on. They wanted more infantry rather than us, and there really wasn't as many German aircraft by that time. Anyway, we stayed there, and most of the guys thought that if they just could get off that tub, they'd be happy. But we then lined up and got ashore. It took about 2 hours for us to get to our location where we were supposed to deploy. Far enough north, it didn't get dark until about 11 o'clock at that time of the year. So we were in place in time to just collapse and go to sleep.
Well, with all that daylight, though, I'm sure you saw some things that most of us have never seen and will never see, and maybe you never wanted to see. Can you describe for us that place on that day? I mean, this is June 7th, 1944. What did you see when you came ashore, and what did you experience for the rest of that day?
Well, there's just unbelievable activity taking place. If there's one thing that I do recall that's different, it is the 2.5-ton trucks loaded with bodies of GIs that had died, and rigor mortis had set them up in whatever shape they were. It caught your attention. And then views that whenever I think about, this is just something that sticks in my mind just like it was yesterday. And that could have been us. Here's how we look going over.
Yeah, so you've got a picture of an LST loaded with trucks and supplies, and then here's Omaha Beach.
Two levels. So anyway, and then here's the beach area. And there was just activity like you can't believe.
And you said it took about 2 hours for you guys to get into your position. So where was that, and did you have anything to fire on in those next couple days?
We were up there near St. Laurent, which is only about 2 miles from the beach, inland, and that's where we were supposed to set up. So we got there and found our places, got our guns set up. I told you earlier that there were times when you were not to fire on anything, and we'd been there about a week when a German plane came over, and by good luck, we knocked the tail off that airplane, and it came down, and it was a Focke-Wulf. Now, anti-aircraft folks did a lot of training on identifying planes, so we knew, at least we thought, we knew what this was. At any rate, we knocked it down.
And when you say identifying planes, you're talking about by their silhouette in the sky, even when they're far off?
Yes, the silhouette. And, of course, as it starts making a strafing run at you, you know, you have an idea that they don't like you.
Well, how frequently did that happen over the, probably, I guess, almost a year from that point?
Well, we had several strafing that came through, but the Germans' Air Force had been reduced a lot by that time, and so there'd be a single plane comes flying fast as it could, and then strafe or dropping some bomb. I recall one time they came over a German bomber and dropped the bombs. And we all stood up and looked at it. We all got knocked down on our backside because of the pressure, the concussion.
Well, I'm sure there are some other close calls you can tell me about. But it strikes me, because your memory is so clear, and people, when they hear me say again, you're 101, they're saying, no way, that's impossible. But you were there. You experienced these things. And I'm sure in all the years since, you've read a lot, you've seen a lot, you've heard a lot said about the Normandy invasion. Is there anything maybe that you think is a misperception, or is there something that most of us don't understand about what it was like to be there that you'd like to share?
Well, I'm going to repeat myself in a way. There was so much action taking place. I don't think the average person can comprehend. There were just ships everywhere. There were airplanes everywhere. Mostly us, or preponderance was our allied. It was an event of such magnitude, it's hard to describe. We were there and saw it, but it's hard to tell another person the magnitude of it.
Jack Wolf, 101 years old, is our guest today. If you head to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, you'll find a brief video of Jack with those top secret invasion orders he's held on to for 75 years. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Some people see the challenge and say, send me. Some hear, it can't be done, and say, I'll do it. Some choose to stand for something bigger than us all. If you're ready to step forward and do your part, then you might be ready to become a soldier in the U.S. Army. It's a diverse team that works together, trains hard, and adapts every day to be ready for anything that comes next. The U.S. Army turns soldiers into leaders capable of split-second decisions, extreme focus, and maximum endurance. These warriors lead their squads on missions armed with more than good intentions. They inspire their fellow soldiers to do better on and off the battlefield, making the Army a lethal and ready force. U.S. Army soldiers blaze a trail that leads to freedom. Do you have what it takes? Find your place on the team. Contact your local Army recruiter or visit goarmy.com/warriors.